The Takeaway is supported by Blue Apron. Blue Apron delivers farm-fresh, perfectly portioned ingredients and step-by-step recipes so you can make incredible meals at home. Visit blueapron.com/takeaway to get your first 3 meals free.
This is The Takeaway for Thanksgiving, November 24th, 2016.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks so much for listening, and I hope you're having a peaceful and restful Thanksgiving holiday. This hour, we're bringing you a show that examines a fundamental value that makes us Americans, the value of freedom.
In the future days that we seek to make secure, we look forward to a world founded upon four essential human freedoms.
There was a speech given long ago in America at a time of great confusion about where we were going. Sound familiar? In the winter of 1941, January, the country had survived the Great Depression and could see the world going back to war. There was reason to feel relieved in America, as well as an anxiety that it would take the United States entering a conflict across the ocean that would tip the balance and prevent fascism from enveloping Europe. Franklin Delano Roosevelt delivered a high-minded speech intended to remind Americans of their core values and success as a nation, decades out from the Civil War and more than 150 years after throwing off the bonds of England to go it alone. This was the Four Freedoms speech delivered on January 6, 1941. But it was also Roosevelt quietly laying the groundwork for what became a rationale for going to war to help the nations of Europe.
The first is freedom of speech and expression everywhere in the world. The second is freedom of every person to worship God in his own way everywhere in the world. The third, freedom from want. The fourth is freedom from fear.
Four freedoms that mean something very different today than they did in 1941. Indeed, later that year, in December of 1941, the attack on Pearl Harbor would change everything.
We interrupt this program to bring you a special news bulletin. The Japanese have attacked Pearl Harbor, Hawaii, by air, President Roosevelt has just announced.
December 7th, 1941, a date which will live in infamy.
Harvey Kay, professor of democracy and justice at the University of Wisconsin-Green Bay and author of The Fight for the Four Freedoms, What Made FDR and the Greatest Generation Truly Great, Kay says that on this Thanksgiving, the multiple meanings of the Four Freedoms tell a story of American strides and missteps in history.
I think when he went before the nation on January 6, 1941, he had in mind the idea that this in many ways was the call to war. That is, it was the fact that he wanted the United States to turn itself into the arsenal of democracy. He wanted the United States to back the British. He wanted the United States to make sure that Nazi Germany was stymied and eventually turned back. So I do think it's, in essence, a call to war. But I think he went beyond that with the idea that if indeed the United States was going to be involved in the war, at first in terms of its industrial might and later perhaps more directly, he wanted Americans to understand two things. First of all, that it did not mean turning back the advances of the 1930s New Deal. So in many ways, when he pronounces the four freedoms, freedom of speech and expression, freedom of religion or freedom of worship, freedom from want and freedom from fear, he's telling Americans, when we go forward, whether it's as the industrial power we are or as the military power we'll become, it's important to realize that we will not sacrifice what we've accomplished. And in fact, he actually says we should be doing more in terms of reforming America and combating poverty, enabling people to secure jobs, and also empowering them with civil rights and civil liberties.
How did Americans view the idea of freedom of speech and expression everywhere in the world? Did they accept that responsibility?
The polls that followed show that Americans actually did subscribe to the Four Freedoms as a vision for America. There's some question as to whether or not they imagined they could accomplish that in the world. And the soldiers who went over, and the sailors and others, what they encountered overseas led them both to see the imperative of improving and bettering America. That's probably why we now know them as the greatest generation. But also, they had serious reservations about the possibility of transforming the rest of the world because of what they encountered there.
Would you say Roosevelt had in his gut a sense that freedom of speech and expression everywhere in the world was something he absolutely believed in, or this was a convenient talking point?
I think it's something he may have believed in, but he was no fool regarding what prevailed in much of the world. So it was a politics, obviously, but it was also a vision that could project beyond the moment. And indeed, I mean, to some extent, let's face it, we won the war with our allies, and in the western part of Europe, we at least provided for the advancement of those four freedoms, not to mention the consequences of the war against Japan and the creation of a liberal democracy there. So I do think it's something that he believed in. Whether or not he imagined this was something that was going to be accomplished anytime soon, he was no fool.
The freedom to worship. Explain how FDR envisioned that freedom to worship.
Well, of course, those are in the Bill of Rights, freedom of speech and freedom of religion. They're in the Bill of Rights. And in fact, many people imagined that we had already accomplished that inside the United States. But then others reminded them that basically these were words that went beyond the idea that you could walk into your selected church and pray as you wished. The idea was you should be able to walk on the streets, whether you were Catholic, Protestant, Jewish, and not fear the consequences of your faith. So I think Roosevelt had in mind the idea that of creating a more secure Americans for people of all faiths, not only when they entered into their religious spaces, but also for going on the streets. Let's not forget that around that time, Father Coughlin had inspired young thugs to attack Jews and others on the streets in places like Boston and Brooklyn, New York. So if one spoke of freedom of worship, it wasn't the idea that say, Jews would just be able to practice their faith. It was also that they should not ever be molested for being Jewish, that they too were U.S. citizens, and this was their right to be able to practice the faith and to be Jewish in a public fashion.
Given the time, January 6, 1941, when FDR lays it out, what does freedom from want mean as Americans heard it then?
That's an interesting thing. If you actually read the latter two of the freedoms, freedom from want and freedom from fear, as he presents them in the speech, he's talking in terms of freedom from want, the creation of international economic relations that will enable countries to economically develop and assure decent lives for their citizens. But when Americans heard it, they actually heard it in terms of the previous 8 years of the New Deal, and that they would extend the New Deal and Social Security into areas that were not yet secured. For example, he made mention of improving health care, and I think Americans imagined that when he said freedom from want, probably first in their minds was probably health care coverage, which, of course, even now we don't have universally in this country. But I think when Americans heard that, they imagined no more going back to the depths of the Depression, and indeed we will enhance what we think of today as Social Security.
What is freedom from fear? That's the one that is most foreign to the Bill of Rights, the kind of things that were written into the Constitution. Freedom from fear seems to be something that comes out of FDR's particular vision.
We may not find these things in the Constitution or the Bill of Rights, but we shouldn't forget that the Declaration of Independence says the right to pursue life, you know, is life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. In many ways, I think when Roosevelt spoke those words and Americans heard them, they had in mind that notion of the Declaration in terms of livelihood and security. Now, when Roosevelt spoke freedom from fear, he spoke in terms of international arrangements which will reduce armaments. I think he had in mind the United Nations, because when he ran for vice president in 1920 on the Democratic ticket, they were defending the League of Nations idea that Wilson had proposed. And I think he had in mind the creation of an international association like the United Nations. But Americans themselves, when they heard freedom from fear, think about what they heard. African Americans in the South, they were living in Jim Crow segregated states. And as far as they were concerned, freedom from fear meant that there was going to be an assurance that their lives would be secure and not subject to, you know, to white supremacist thuggery, that kind of thing. Jews, again, when they heard freedom from fear, they believed that meant they would be able to walk the streets of Boston and Brooklyn or anywhere else without fearing some young thugs who were going to pounce on them. And I think generally Americans imagined that it would mean that they would not worry whether or not they would have a job, whether or not they would have a home, whether or not they would have food, whether or not they'd be able to send their kids to school. It meant the fundamentals of what we think of as the good life in America. Although Roosevelt, as I said, when he mentioned freedom from want and freedom from fear, was not so specific in a sort of social democratic fashion. But most Americans heard it that way. And if I could just add, when Roosevelt returned to this subject in 1944 in his State of the Union address then, and he offered the idea that he proposed a second Bill of Rights, an economic Bill of Rights, 85% of Americans endorsed that idea of an economic Bill of Rights. In polls, after polls during that year, it was indicated that they wanted national health care, they wanted aid for students to go to college. I mean, they wanted the things that were implied in the Four Freedoms and that he spoke of in the economic Bill of Rights.
When Pearl Harbor happened, it seems that if you look at American history, the Four Freedoms were tossed out the window on some level.
Tragically so, yes.
Yes. Explain how those freedoms were violated once Pearl Harbor completely redefined America's role in the world.
The foremost violation, one of the worst cases, most tragic incidents in American civil liberties and civil rights history, was the fact that California interests and military interests persuaded Roosevelt to issue an executive order in which Japanese Americans living on the West Coast would be interned to camps in the interior from Utah, Arizona, Arkansas. And I mean, that was a denial of fundamental rights of American freedom. So that most of all, I think, is the first great tragedy. The other one, which was, again, something that the military was demanding, was the segregation of the military so that African-American troops were recruited but placed into their own companies in the Marines, in the Army, and eventually the Navy gave way and had blacks in their ranks beyond the mess halls, the galleys. But it's the case, of course, that what's interesting about that is that that was the only, if you like, racial / ethnic group in America that was confined to their own units, other than, of course, the Japanese Americans whose families were being interned and they were placed into Japanese American combat teams. Mexican Americans were fully integrated into the military and 400,000 served. Native Americans were integrated. America's racial history is a tragic and a contradictory one.
As we think about Thanksgiving in 2016, with all the complicated, new history that we have to deal with since the election, what would you say is the state of the Four Freedoms as we sit down to turkey and dressing?
I think there's reason to be anxious about the Four Freedoms. You know, the Four Freedoms paintings by Norman Rockwell, which in many ways were the visual images that promoted the ideas of the Four Freedoms. There's that image, of course, of the grandmother placing the turkey on the table. Those are wonderful images, and every American should be entitled to experience that. But I think given the campaign that we've seen this past year, it's all too often that there was a promotion of a freedom to fear. And maybe among those fears is the degree to which freedom from want will remain high on any public agenda if you consider the challenges that will now arise to things such as Medicare and Medicaid.
Harvey Kay, professor of democracy and justice at the University of Wisconsin-Green Bay and author of The Fight for the Four Freedoms, What Made FDR and the Greatest Generation Truly Great. Professor Kay, Harvey Kay, thank you so much.
Thank you, John. Good to talk to you.
Our conversation about FDR's Four Freedoms continues all this hour. Stay with us.
What is freedom?
Freedom of speech.
At this point, free speech is nothing more than a nuisance.
Freedom of worship.
Wake up, Christian America. You are being mocked.
Freedom from want.
We would actually go in Walmart and clean ourselves up before we go to
sleep. Yeah, in the bathroom.
Save some money.
Freedom from fear.
I'll tell you what freedom is to me. No fear.
As we learned in our discussion with Harvey Kay, freedom from fear was one of the first casualties of World War II. And fear is where we begin our examination of the state of President Franklin Delano Roosevelt's Four Freedoms as he set them up in 1941. What Roosevelt didn't know in January of 1941 was that in under a year's time, the Japanese would attack Pearl Harbor, thrusting the United States into World War II. For Japanese-American Setsuko Winchester, the infamy was how the United States turned on itself during World War II. She's a ceramicist, a former NPR journalist, and as outraged as she is about the Pearl Harbor attacks, this freedom from fear had a deeply personal and painful connotation. after Pearl Harbor Japanese Americans were rounded up and held in internment camps. Setsuko has been telling their story with handmade tea bowls painted yellow that she photographs at the site of internment camps she's visited around the country. Setsuko says the bowls are her symbol of fear, symbolizing a freedom promised by FDR and that freedom withdrawn.
I think he thought that he was going to make America safe for Americans and that Americans deserve to be able to go to bed feeling safe within their homes. For example, that's the painting that's depicted in Norman Rockwell's painting in the Four Freedoms Rotunda in Stockbridge at his the Norman Rockwell Museum. When I go visit that painting, I think he did not mean it for me.
No.
And that freedom from fear meant freedom from me, that I'm what people were fearful of. Because if I was born, you know, in a different age, and it was 1942 today, I know that I would be the target of that fear. My family would be told to assemble at some racetrack and then sent in covered trains to someplace out in the middle of a desert and left there for 4 years. They would have lost their businesses and their homes, and no one would ever talk about it again.
The Japanese internment experience that you're describing there is both a fear that motivated an extraordinary loss of freedom for American citizens, Japanese Americans in this case. And it raised the question of freedom from fear. What so many Americans fear is not something outside our borders, but fear of what the American government might do during this 2016 campaign. Are you having thoughts about that?
Yes, I think that it feels very, very similar. By 1942, most of them had been born there or had lived there for decades, and still they were considered foreigners. And I know today I'm still considered a foreigner. I'm not an American. Asians are not Americans. Asians are not part of the American story. They're almost invisible. And even the fact that Japanese internment happened is invisible. What part of my project was to visit the camps because I didn't learn about it growing up. And I finally decided when my husband, who's a writer, became an American citizen in 2011, I had to think about what it meant to be an American. Who's an American? You know, who belongs here, and how long do you have to be here to be considered an American? And I realized that I had to find out my history. And my history is not being Japanese. My history is being Japanese American.
What do your ceramics represent in this art project?
I'm a ceramicist, and I hand-pinch 120 tea bowls, and I glaze them various shades of yellow. And they're all different sizes, and they're supposed to represent people. I made 120 to represent 120,000 individuals that were incarcerated. Some were children. A lot of them were children. Some were mothers, fathers. They were just human.
Is it sensitive for you as a Japanese American to raise this issue? Have you heard from other Japanese Americans?
I haven't really tried to tell anybody. I just started doing it for myself. It was just a personal response. And I decided I wanted to visit the camps. And people started asking about it and sort of taken on a life of its own, especially when I took it to the Four Freedoms Park in New York.
What was that like?
It was exhilarating in a way that I can look at the phrases that FDR wrote and show that I know I'm not part of it, and I don't see why.
It's an emotional issue.
Yeah, I think I've never really talked about it before, especially not publicly. And it's not something that you get taught in school. I know everybody says they're taught in school. A lot of people say that. But I also know a lot of people. I was out in L.A., and I asked all kinds of people, and a lot of them say, I've never heard of that. I didn't know that. And if they do learn about it, they say that it was inevitable, that the Japanese had to be put away. But I have to say the Germans weren't put away. Neither was the mayor of New York, who was Italian.
Is part of the message of your art project and the passion that you feel for all of this is that the vigilance that's required to preserve this of the four freedoms, this freedom from fear, and that that's part of the statement you're trying to make?
Yes. I think FDR understood it, but I think that he had to do it. I think he was a politician, you know. Eleanor Roosevelt fought him. She's my hero. I think she really understands what America is about and stood up for it. But in the end, you know, she had to support her husband.
What do you think the message of these T-bulls is?
I just want to remind people that, you know, fear is human. It's natural. But and I understand that. I understand that people are afraid, but that most human beings, and I truly believe this, want to cooperate. They'd rather build something together than to destroy things. And being Japanese, I think you know, when you live in a country where there's so many earthquakes and tidal waves and tsunamis, and it's hard to build something together. Most people in America come here because they believe in America's message. And I do, too. I think that it's pretty amazing that people from all over the world, all kinds of religions, all kind of ethnicities can get together and create some place like New York and get along. And it's so magical and rich. And I hope that that doesn't have to die because people are afraid.
Setsuko Winchester, Japanese-American ceramicist, former NPR journalist and a passionate artist. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Huckenberry. Of the four freedoms of FDR, freedom of speech is perhaps the most familiar. But in practice, especially in a time of Google and Facebook, it's a real monster with lots of thorny, unanticipated consequences, along with being a pillar of traditional liberty and democracy. Stephen Thrasher, senior columnist for The Guardian U.S., understands this. When The Guardian recently analyzed 70 million comments from its website over the past decade to better understand which writers received the most negative comments, 8 were women and the other 2 were black men. Thrasher was one of them. How has this freedom of speech evolved since 1941? Thrasher says, for starters, there are plenty more platforms available to people these days, and a warning. Thrasher uses some adult language here.
The number of channels of communication are much more now. They're much wider. When you look back at Roosevelt's era, we're talking about only a few broadcasters, only a few publication outlets. And of course, everything is much wider now. But something that's quite similar is that we always have to wonder, whose speech are we talking about? So if you're thinking about it in the 1940s, Roosevelt obviously is not thinking necessarily about the freedom of the speech of the Japanese, for example.
No.
And whose speech is going to be included at the table and permitted to be heard on a wide scale is always going to be a very contested thing, no matter the historical period you're talking about.
Looking at it from the standpoint of there's more speech now and more different kinds of speech now, what do you make of the abusive targeting of people online? Is that something that it's better to have out in the open, reveals something about our society? What do you think?
I have very ambivalent feelings about comments on stories. When I worked at the Village Voice years ago, everything was allowed to be said. And so as I talked about in the Guardian story, you know, people would routinely call me a or a and nobody would take it out of the comments. The Guardian does siphon those comments out. And we looked at 70 million comments over about a decade. And out of 12,000 writers, I was one of the top 10 people to have my comments filtered because people would just say such vitriolic things. And I've certainly learned from talking to particularly women colleagues and women colleagues of color, they can be writing about very uncontroversial things, and yet people will still come at them with these really horrifying things. So as a publication, I don't mind comments getting taken out. I don't see that as a stifling of speech. And I've certainly, in terms of technology, seen that over my career, people have started talking much more through Twitter and through Facebook, which I think those conversations would be more generative because they can be with people you know or sort of people that are in your circle. Everything is going to get out there in some way. Sometimes I will look at sites like Stormfront to see what white supremacists are talking about. And organizations like the Southern Poverty Law Center and hate group watchdogs will look at those places and find interesting things. But I don't know that it's always helpful to have that stuff always lobbed at writers of color, gay writers, women writers who are very unlikely to have much free speech because they're highly unlikely to even get journalism jobs in the first place.
That refers to discrimination, which of course has the consequence of limiting speech. If it limits the number of people who can actually speak to the nation through journalistic institutions. But there are many other ways to speak to the nation today. Do you think that speech is freer and more open today with these mechanisms, or are we enforcing a kind of politically correct speech that makes it harder to say certain things without getting in all kinds of trouble?
I don't think we're making it harder. People are definitely going on the offense to try to have more speech, and we certainly see ways that it has an effect. The killing of Mike Brown is something that we first learned about through social media. A lot of the police deaths we first learned about through social media, and so they didn't have to go through the filter of journalism to kind of come into the public consciousness, and that's a really important thing.
We have to take a short break. When we return, more from Stephen Thrasher on the freedom of speech. Stay with us.
Support for The Takeaway comes from Lumosity, brain training developed by scientists and game designers who turn cognitive research tasks into games to challenge memory, attention, and problem solving. Learn more at lumosity.com. The Takeaway is supported by Blue Apron. Blue Apron partners with sustainable farms, fisheries, and ranchers to bring you all the ingredients you need to create incredible home-cooked meals. Ingredients come paired with an easy-to-follow recipe card, delivered to your door weekly in a refrigerated box. Rediscover how fun cooking can be while enjoying specialty ingredients and exploring new flavors and cuisines. Get your first three Blue Apron meals free plus free shipping by visiting blueapron.com/takeaway.
Continuing our conversation now with Stephen Thrasher, senior columnist for The Guardian U.S., talking with us about how freedom of speech is being used today by activists who are going on the offensive to make sure their voices get heard.
We've also seen through the Black Lives Matter movement activists who are very willing to try to take the microphone from politicians when President Clinton is sort of saying his speech is being curtailed when he's being interrupted. I don't think that's a really fair frame. People like President Clinton have had 400 years of having the microphone. And so when an activist tries to also say, hey, you know, we have something to say that's worthy of a wide audience and tries to upstage him, I don't think that his free speech is being curtailed. I think there we're actually seeing democracy in action and seeing competing visions for the country trying to get attention. We can say that it's impolite, that it's not fair, that they should wait their turn, but those people aren't likely going to get their turn unless they very directly confront, you know, somebody in a setting like that.
Roosevelt intended that the U.S. would enter World War II to fight for freedom of speech in places around the world against the dictators, as you call them, in 1941. What would you say the global, you know, track record is of freedom of speech in light of Charlie Hebdo and some of the issues that constrain speech around the world?
Roosevelt intended, and the Founding Fathers intended, to have a sense of free speech from a very particular sense of themselves and over who was going to be speaking. And that is always challenged in different countries. We have a different sense of satire in the United States than they do in France with Charlie Hebdo. It's very different in England and the United States as well. And I think we always need to keep in mind that what we think of as free speech is very linked to our own politics and economics in this country.
But does that mean that freedom of speech should involve the ability to make someone really angry with something that you will do either satirically or otherwise?
Free speech is going to make people angry. I think when journalists are doing it right, it's going to make people in power angry. So it's strange when President Obama will weigh in on the media. It's strange, you know, to hear him say that in a way because the N-word Snowden leaks were, you know, something that the Obama administration responded to very aggressively in terms of putting Chelsea Manning in solitary confinement and in terms of going very aggressively after people who leak. The Obama administration has gone after people, I would say, as hard as the Nixon administration is to plug leaks in the press. And what is free speech in that way? I mean, free speech is not sort of this this crystal clear thing. You can argue about people who work for the government releasing documents. Is that free speech? I think we really needed the Snowden documents to come out. The same thing with the Panama Papers. Things that are secret, journalists need to bring to the fore. And so the United States government will have a project ostensibly of saying that it wants to have more free speech around the world, but it doesn't particularly want the Panama Papers out. It certainly didn't want the Snowden Papers out. And it's very aggressive in trying to keep those kinds of things from coming to the fore.
Would you fight for free speech elsewhere than the place where you live? In other words, is free speech so important that you would put yourself in danger?
I write very openly about my life, and I will deal with the consequences. And that's something that I do as a journalist and many people do as journalists. And I think that we're seeing a really beautiful wave of protesters right now who are putting themselves and their sense of free speech on the line when they do go to a Trump rally and speak out, or when they challenge President Clinton or Secretary Clinton or Senator Sanders. I think that people are sort of putting themselves out there in a particular way. I think it's more admirable not to say we need to go to war with a certain country to expand their free speech. I think it's more important to look at the young transgender people of color who are expressing themselves and expressing their free speech and their protest in states like Mississippi and North Carolina right now, because they're putting themselves in harm's way. And they're not doing it in a way that furthers militarism or economic hegemony. They're doing it in a way that tries to expand American freedom right here within our country.
Stephen Thrasher is a writer at large and senior columnist for The Guardian. In U.S. He's a doctoral fellow in American Studies at NYU. Stephen, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Support for The Takeaway comes from TIAA. Whether it's investing, advice, banking, or retirement, TIAA is dedicated to helping those who teach, heal, and serve others achieve a lifetime of financial well-being. Learn more at TIAA.org. And American Express. American Express has cards and services designed for businesses of all sizes. Learn more at open.com.
Freedom from want. What is the federal government's responsibility to satisfy your wants? Think about it. This FDR freedom from want from the Four Freedoms speech in 1941 seems the hardest to achieve in practice. We are a sizable nation of wants. Almost 47 million people live in the United States of wanting. 14.9% of the country is in poverty. For African Americans and Hispanics, that number tops 20%. Father Timothy Graff is director of the Office of Human Concerns for the Archdiocese of Newark, New Jersey. He worries about how to satisfy this country of so many different wants as he shifts his gaze from the city skyline to the poor neighborhoods that he serves every single day.
Well, I think what FDR was saying is he's saying, what's your attitude? What is the attitude of the country? But what is the attitude of each citizen? So he's really calling for a widening of the vision. And I see so much, both individually and as a country, we're lessening our vision. We're making it narrower rather than the wider, which I think FDR was asking the country to look at.
And poverty is more of a problem today than it was then.
It is. You know, I talk to people every day. You know, they talk about the economic rebound that we had. Well, I'm sure some people rebounded, but it hasn't on most. In the tough economic times we find ourselves, when we're looking at government programs, we're looking at the budget is a moral document. You know, our budget, our numbers, our money, that's where we show our priorities. Are we trying to balance the budget on the backs of the poor? Don't demonize the poor, which is so often happens within the electoral process. You know, everyone needs to have another. No, well, it's those people over there. And it could be the poor, it could be immigrants, it could be women, it could be whoever. If those people didn't take my money, then we'd be okay.
Do you think you can articulate what is a freedom from want? I feel as though we haven't really come to grips with what is a comfortable sort of floor from which to build a society.
Well, I think what it's not is that which the federal government says is a living reality. It just doesn't work. How is it that a person or a family can live in a way in which they're not worrying about whether the next thing that comes down the pike will put them on the street? They're looking for decent, affordable housing. which again is very difficult in this area of the Northeast where we are for a myriad of different reasons. They're looking for food security, meaning basically, do I have enough at the end of the month to feed my family? They're looking for decent education. They're looking for a decent job with a living wage. Pope Francis, who's a great friend of the poor, has talked about a living wage. We've talked about that since actually 1890 in the documents from the popes. So I think those are the basics. And basically what people are looking for is they're looking for a sense of security.
So our society should be constructed as a means to have some kind of job, a connection to the community, which pays enough so that my family will have food security and health care. And from that point on, it's up to me to do more than that.
We're dealing with really two different populations at times. There's a part of our population that's going to be chronically unemployable because of disabilities, because of age, because of other issues that they deal with. They're simply not going to fit into the economy. They just can't work for whatever reasons. And then you're going to have people who are chronically underemployed. And the chronically underemployed are those who are working one, two, three jobs. And they're still barely, if, getting by, you know. And so really what the safety net that we would talk about would be providing for those who are in need, unemployment insurance. You know, and what we're seeing both federally and within states is those being drawn back more and more and more. You know, we're seeing within so many of our own parishes and our own Catholic charities, less people coming to the soup kitchens and to our food pantries. It's more. We say that with the economic downturn of 6-7 years ago, the face of poverty changed literally. You know, it's much more suburban. It's much more rural than it was 10 years ago. I remember I was at a meeting with leaders of our food pantries within our parishes, my archdiocese. And so I was meeting with them and they said, is there a change that you've seen in terms of upkick? And some people said, oh yes, it's between 35 and 45% more people looking for food, food assistance, food security. And so one guy said, oh no, we haven't seen anything, we're fine. And the guy next to him started laughing. And so the guy said, why are you laughing? He goes, all the people from your parish are coming to my food pantry because I'm next door. Mm. And they're embarrassed to come because they know the people from the parish at your food pantry.
You know, the idea that you will come into a food pantry and not feel as though, boy, I'm sure glad this is here, but will instead feel as though you're being caught committing a crime.
Yes.
That, how does that change? Because in some sense, these institutions should be part of the freedom from want.
Well, one of the great things about our food pantries, what we're always saying to people is, remember the people that you serve are your brothers and sisters. That whole idea of solidarity, the whole idea of brotherhood and sisterhood, that we're all in this together. But what it is how do we treat those who come to us? You know, we had a food drive many years ago in one of the parishes I was in. And so we were collecting money and groceries outside one of the local supermarkets. And this guy comes by and he gives us the smallest can of corn you'd ever want to see. He says, I just want to thank you for being here. Last year I was unemployed and I had addiction problems and I came to your food pantry and you helped me. He said, I just needed a couple months' help till I got my act back together. I got a job. He says, it's not a great job. I'd like to give you more food, but I can't. All I can give you is this can of corn. That's all I have this week. Maybe next week I can give you more. But what it showed me was, you know, we're all in this together. Why do we have soup kitchens? Why do we have food pantries? Coming from a Catholic tradition, we're serving them because in them we see God. How do you show your love for God? You love your neighbor. We don't serve them because they're Catholic. We serve them because we're Catholic. This is what our faith calls us to do. So that's just, it's just what we as people of faith have to do every day.
Father Timothy Graff, thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
Support for The Takeaway comes from Lumosity with a 10-minute fit test to challenge memory, attention, and problem-solving, training programs that draw from 50 brain games, and tools to compare scores with global averages. Learn more at lumosity.com. the Henry Luce Foundation, for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia. The Takeaway's resilience reporting is supported by the Rockefeller Foundation. For more, go to rockfound.org.
You're listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI Public Radio International in collaboration with The New York Times and WGBH Boston Public Radio.
When President Franklin Delano Roosevelt outlined the four freedoms back in 1941, he was making an argument over what was worth fighting for as he laid the rationale for going back to war, World War II. But as important as the fight against fascism was in 1941, there was certainly much freedom to be fought for yet in America's own internal struggles. That fight was being waged in the diversity of churches in 1941, from the African-American denominations throughout the South, fighting for racial justice, the AME churches everywhere in the U.S., to the traditional rural churches of the heartland. In 2016, religion became a flashpoint in the election campaign when Donald Trump openly called for suspicion of Muslims in the fight against terrorism. But Islam is not a newcomer to America. Listen to this uplifting conversation with Muslim chaplain Lieutenant Colonel Dawood Agbari of the U.S. Army. His belief in freedom of worship is as strong as his defense of it throughout his military service.
In 1941, Islam may not have actually crossed the mind of the president. But today, just like other minority faith groups, today Islam is front and center in our discussions in this country. So as a Muslim chaplain, if I find myself being a Muslim chaplain within a community that probably will consider me as a minority, it speaks a lot about this, the greatness of this country, a country where everyone can belong. Everyone can feel that they are part and parcel of the fabric of their society. So yes, I'm walking out there and I may be the only Muslim, but I can identify with the soldiers what their mission is, and they can identify with me as one of them who really is there for them.
Has a Muslim or even a Christian soldier come to you ever in the course of your work during these conflicts in the Middle East and said, sometimes I feel the United States is against Islam, sometimes I feel the United States is intolerant of Islam? Or has a Christian said, sometimes I feel as though Islam is the enemy of the United States? How have you dealt with those things?
So soldiers have their own feelings. And often it's not that they are really questioning as much as they are exploring. But yes, people do have struggles. And they will come and they want to figure out, you know, what is going on? Can you help me understand all of these issues you are facing? So, but when you lay it down and you are able to explain to them what the differences are, what the challenges are, what are the causes, and often they will end up realizing, even though religion seems to be the root of a lot of these challenges, then they come to realize actually religion is just a foil for all of what is happening. But at the root of it are a lot of issues, whether it's cultural issues, whether it's tribal issues, whether they are political or even basically economic issues. But religion is a very strong force to use to rally people. So those are the things you explain to soldiers, and then they begin to see the big picture and begin to understand that, yes, we may be talking about religion, but there is more to what we are talking than what is really happening on the ground.
How does your experience here in the United States differ from where you grew up?
So that is a very interesting question, because I grew up in Ghana, West Africa, where actually the tribe is what really drives a lot of issues. And within your household, you can have some of your families are Muslims, some of the families are Christians, or even traditional African religion. So, you know, it's so surprising you come to America and just the crescent on your uniform means a lot. But the unique things about America is the fact that everybody can belong. Everybody can belong. So, I mean, I go to places, and if they get to know that I'm a chaplain in the U.S. Army, I mean, even the very idea that somebody from Ghana, West Africa, with this big accent, will be a lieutenant colonel in the U.S. Army. It surprises people. And I have been in this army now for about 17 years, and I have had nothing but to be grateful. I have had soldiers who will not even talk to, they know I'm a Muslim, and they will not talk to a Christian chaplain because I am their chaplain.
So as a Muslim cleric, the emphasis is on scholarship. But in the army, that's where you learned pastoral care?
Absolutely. As a Muslim cleric, as a Muslim chaplain, most of my education is more about scholarship. What does the Quran say? What does the tradition say? The army is not employing me to tell soldiers, you know, this is wrong. The army is employing me to find a solution to what I think is wrong. And that is the difference. That is where pastoral care comes in. I can stand out there and say, hey, adultery is not good. Infidelity is not good. But infidelity may be a disease. You have diagnosed it. What is the solution to it? That is where the chaplain comes in. How can we help that soldier to overcome suicidal thoughts? How can we help that soldier to overcome financial challenges? How can we make that soldier a good husband, a good wife? And that is the challenge that the army throws at you. But as I said, the army will help train you, but you also then find from that training what you can use in addition to your faith tradition to become a better caregiver.
So you're a caregiver, and you're one of the very few Muslims in the U.S. military, and you're also an immigrant, and your understanding of American freedoms is not the same as my understanding. But I'm wondering if, as a chaplain in the Army and as a Muslim chaplain in the Army, that you find yourself as someone who's out there not only protecting the soldiers, but protecting that freedom of worship that Roosevelt talked about 75 years ago.
One thing people don't realize, if you go out there and fight and stand with that soldier for their religious freedom, you are actually standing for your own religious freedom.
Hmm.
Because once that soldier loses their freedom, you are going to lose yours. So we are working and fighting for the right of soldiers to exercise the freedom that this country has guaranteed them. And in doing so, we are actually fighting for our own freedom. This is a very unique country when it comes to a lot of these freedoms. I can absolutely tell you, there are Muslims in this country who really enjoy being Muslims in this country than maybe from where they came from. Absolutely. They have the freedom here to be better Muslims because nobody is forcing it on them. Nobody is imposing it on them. They are doing because they think it's the right thing to do. They are doing it out of their own conscience. Whereas where they came from, they are likely doing it because somebody is forcing them to do it. And I think the beauty of faith, the beauty of religion is when you practice it because it is what you believe in. It's not what somebody thinks you have to do.
So 75 years after Roosevelt's speech enumerating the freedom to worship, that freedom, you believe, is alive and well.
Absolutely, regardless of what others want us to believe. And actually here at the Pentagon, where I am currently, the Pentagon chaplain is where we meet every Friday for our Friday services. That is where the Jewish community meets, the same building. You have Muslims praying in that building. You have the Jewish praying in that same building, and you have the Christians also praying in this same chapel. One chapel is accommodating all of us, and everybody have their time of allotted to them for their service.
Well, Chaplain Lieutenant Colonel Daoud Agberi, thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thank you for the opportunity.
That's our show for today. Happy Thanksgiving to all our listeners. We thank you for spending time with us, for listening, for participating, for making our show what it is every single day. We hope we gave you some food for thought today on top of your food on the table. Think about your freedoms, enjoy them. And remember, if you want to take the takeaway with you, you are free to subscribe to our podcast. That's right, you can find us on iTunes, take us with you on your commute home from work. A great way to stay up on the news, again, find us on iTunes or any other service you use to get your podcasts. Thanks so much for listening. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
PRI, Public Radio International.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, The New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.